Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From Built It Productions, it's The Great Creators. Conversations about creativity with some of the most celebrated actors, musicians, and performers of our time. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, Tom Hanks and how an early failure led to a lucky break that would change his life forever.
I love my job, and that what goes along with that, I think, is a responsibility to always walk this razor fine line between truth and falsehood, between, you know, consistency and presence.
Tom Hanks is one of those actors often mentioned in the same breath as Jimmy Stewart or Spencer Tracy or Gregory Peck and Henry Fonda. He's one of the most successful actors in Hollywood history and one of only two people ever to win back-to-back Oscars for Best Actor. The other, by the way, was Spencer Tracy. Tom Hanks has had more iconic roles than most actors have had actual roles. Think about just a few Tom Hanks movies for a sec. Saving Private Ryan, Forrest Gump, Big, Castaway, Apollo 13, Sleepless in Seattle, Toy Story. I'm willing to bet you've probably seen most, if not all, of those films. When I was reading up on Tom before this interview, I was kind of stunned at how many of his 80-plus movies I've seen. And even though it's kind of become a bit of a cliche, Tom Hanks is really, really nice and really, really thoughtful. In fact, nicer than you can imagine. And it's not an affect or a pose, and it doesn't always mean he's always nice. Anyway, on this episode of the show, you'll hear how Tom learned the art of role-playing by horsing around with his siblings, how he built a unique and collaborative relationship with directors, including Ron Howard, Robert Zemeckis, and Steven Spielberg, how a chance encounter with baseball legend Joe DiMaggio gave him perspective on his own career, what he learned from Paul Newman about self-consciousness, and what Priscilla Presley thought of his role as Colonel Tom Parker in Elvis. That's all coming up after this break.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, before we get back to the show, I've got a quick ask. If you are enjoying The Great Creators, please help us out and tell someone about it, or better yet, post a review or a comment. You can find us on social media by searching The Great Creators. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and I'm on TikTok as Guy Raz. We hope you'll spread the word, and thanks. Okay, let's get back to the show. Tom Hanks spent most of his childhood moving around. His parents were divorced, and he mainly lived with his dad. By the age of 10, Tom had lived in 10 different houses, but something about all of that change seemed, well, exciting.
Magic always came along. Magic by way of, we are moving. Magic by way of, we're leaving these people, and we're going to go start completely all over. And when you're young and you think that life has a degree of permanence, and that permanence is not necessarily great. You know, I'm not having a good time in this house, in this school, in this neighborhood. And then one of your parents comes in and says, we're leaving. And you hop in the car and you drive away. And it is like, well, that took care of that.
Right.
That's done. And now we'll go over to a new place. And there's new furniture. And there might be, you know, there's new friends to make. And my joke is my dad would take the three of us out on the driveway and say, well, kids, your school is somewhere in that direction. Why don't you just walk that way, and when you see kids your own age, follow them, and they will lead you to the place where you're going to school from now on. And now, that's a joke, but it's not that far off. So this concept of magic, if you just wait, something new will come along and alter your stature and your status and your time in your neighborhood. So you just end up having the same faith in that magic. Oh, this magic occurred and here it is. And you sort of like finally land in a place that needs no altering.
Yeah. I'm wondering how you as a teenager became interested in theater, because you were, I mean, from what I understand, I mean, you were going across, you grew up in Oakland basically, and you're going across the bay to the city of San Francisco to like see The Iceman Cometh, you know, like, which is pretty sophisticated stuff for a teenager. How did you get drawn to that? Was there a teacher? Was there somebody?
It was at Skyline High School in Oakland, and it's a 3-year high. They have 3-year high schools in Oakland, and so my sophomore year, my first year in high school, you're definitely, you know, low man on the totem pole. And I just thought high school for my sophomore year was just like some bad version of every TV show you've ever seen about high school. What do? Well, you take chemistry and you run track. And there's a clique and a social hierarchy that maybe you take part of it. And I hung out with kind of like a spiritual crowd. We talked about highfalutin things. But as far as going to school itself, it was just a place to do time, you know, 6 periods, 6 classes, a level of disinterest. But then friends of mine were in a play, the school play. And I went just to see my pals in it, and it was a real play. I mean, it was the big auditorium, and it was like a theater, and there was a set, and there was lightings, and there's people I knew up there, and they were performing in Dracula. And I just thought, what is this? Where did this come from? Is this something you do in school? And the next year, I was in quote-unquote drama class, and my teacher was a man by the name of Raleigh Farnsworth, and he was a career educator of theater arts. He was a guy who found the great pleasure of teaching drama. We had a class, the classroom actually had a stage in it with a curtain and rudimentary lights. And when we would perform our assignments, the lights in the room would go off and the only lights on would be up on the stage. So it was like a little theater. And it was just like a classroom for algebra or powermatics, except there was a theater on the end of it. And I just thought I lucked into a scam that could get you through school. This is a place where you come and you learn lines and you play around. And none of it was homework and none of it was work. I just saw that. And I said, this is the greatest way to go to school, because this is what I do all the time anyway. Yeah. This is what I do on the bus at home, goof around and say things in as loud and as attention-getting format as possible.
I know that you got into theater in high school, and obviously you decided to pursue it after high school. But I wonder, like, we've had guests on the show who are, it's almost like they're Division I athletes. Like, most professional athletes have at least one parent who played Division I sports, and a lot of actors. Like, we had Sigourney Weaver on, and her mother was a famous actor in Britain, you know, and she almost had, it's like she has the gene, right? And you didn't have any of that in your family, and I wonder if there was a point in high school, because you decided to pursue this when you left high school, right? So it seems like there must have been somebody who said to you, Tom, you're really good at this. Like, you should pursue this thing, because it's kind of a crazy decision to make. I mean, it is the least stable, least promising career to pursue. It's so hard to make a living. And you must have, I'm assuming somebody said, you know, you should pursue this. You're good at it.
I didn't know that was a living that you could pursue.
Right.
I get doing plays in high school, the high school play, yeah. You know, that's part and parcel to, you know, Americana, you know. I will say this, that Mr. Farnsworth was the guy who pegged me as the man with energy,
wow.
The guy who came into the room, the guy that you could just say, just hit the on switch and I took off. Now, that came from 2.5 years of my dad was not married. He was working in the restaurant business. My sister and my brother and I were all alone for most of the day, right up through dinner and right up through doing whatever our homework was and going to bed. And all we did in this small apartment in Alameda, California, was goof around and entertain ourselves.
Yeah.
And I was the youngest person, and my sister was hilarious, and my brother was hilarious. And of course, fists flew and, you know, screams were yeah. done, and we all threw stuff at each other. But on your average Saturday, Sunday, and even on school nights, we turned the doing of the laundry into a massive production, or the making of a dinner into a hilarious sitcom. We just did it naturally because we're just entertaining ourselves, and there was no governor, you know, there was nobody telling us what it was. So that energy that I ended up discovering that there was a place to do it, and Mr. Farnsworth, look, he cast me as things where I was the energy
yeah.
of something. Never the lead, but the guy who had to have energy. I was Sir Andrew Aguecheek in 12th Night. Who does 12th Night in high school? And then I was just going to junior college because that's what I couldn't get into anything. And so I was just going to junior college. And I ran into John Gilkerson, who had played Sebastian in 12th Night. And he was a true creature of the theater. He was a puppeteer. He belonged to the International Guild of Marionette Artists when he was only 15 wow. years old. He was one of those guys that just lived this world of creativity. And at one point, we stayed in the Bay Area when everybody else went off to their universities, and I ran into one, and he says, "You're not taking any drama classes?" I said, "Well, no, I'm not." He says, "Shame on you." He literally said those
wow.
words, "Shame on
wow.
you. You should. You should be taking drama classes, and you should be doing shows. Shame on you." And he rattled me, and I realized that, okay, that's a wonderful vote of confidence, but I also, he said it in a way that reminded me that I missed it so. I missed the juju of being in a class and learning lines and being critiqued and having to perform for somebody. So from that, I took a drama class every quarter. I'm seeing, because it's a school assignment, I'm seeing The Iceman Cometh at Berkeley Rep, and I'm seeing Desire Under the Elms and Peer Gynt and The Merry Wives of Windsor at ACT, American Conservatory Theater. I'm going
wow.
anywhere in order to see professional theater. And that's when this gong went off in my head that says, this is a job.
Wow.
This is a thing that these people are getting paid
yeah.
to do. I had no idea of how to do it. I was in college, so then I decided maybe the thing to do is make theater arts my major in
yeah.
school. And I ended up doing that. The truth is, you can say, you know, what was the secret to your career? What was the first job you got? And
yeah.
I said, that's not nearly as important as the job I didn't get. I was not cast in a show at my state college in Sacramento. And so all my friends were. And so I had nothing to do except go audition for this other play that was being done somewhere in town. And I ended up getting cast in that, which was directed by Vincent Dowling of the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival in Cleveland, who was hiring young people to go
wow.
off and be interns in his company.
In Cleveland.
Because he needed bodies to move these sets around and also to carry spears and have one lines in Hamlet and things
so,
like
so
that.
So the role you wanted, do you remember the play that you didn't get? What was the play?
Oh, yeah. I was not cast in Joe Orton's What the Butler
okay,
Saw.
So you weren't cast in What the Butler
all
Saw.
All my friends were, yeah.
So you try out for a play that is also in Sacramento at the time.
Yeah, I was in Sacramento. It was at a place that is now called, I think it's called Sacramento Actors Theater. It was called something else back then. And it was the Cherry Orchard, Chekhov's The Cherry
okay,
Orchard.
Okay, so you were cast in this Chekhov play. Had you not been cast in that play, it's like the sliding doors, right? It's like you go left yeah. or you go right and you don't get this role. You get this other role. It turns out the guy directing it is actually based in Cleveland, and he runs this this Shakespeare Festival out there.
He's there because somebody in his company had come from the same festival. So he's there as a guest director.
Wow.
And if I had been cast in the play at college, I would not have met the man. I would not have played Yasha.
Wow.
And he would not have said, I think you could be an actor if you want to be, you could be an actor. And then he offered me a job in which he didn't pay anything.
You ended up going and moving to Cleveland for like 2 years.
I ended up doing 3 seasons there.
Because I know you got to New York around 1979. As you mentioned, you were so young, 22, you had your first kid. And you are moving there to become a stage actor, right? I mean, that is your pursuit. You're not thinking television films. You're thinking,
I'm going to go
and become a stage actor. And what do you remember about that time? And we think about the late 70s, early 80s and New York City.
If you just picture a taxi driver,
right?
Robert De Niro. That's what New York City was.
Yeah.
It was. I got very lucky because I did not have to take a regular job because 25 weeks of work in Ohio with a contract qualified me for 25 weeks of unemployment from the state of Ohio. So I was getting. I did not have to wait tables. I did not have to get that kind of job. I was able just to eventually go in and sign and barely survive.
Yeah.
What happened there was you end up trying to do anything at all in order just to perform, not get paid, just to perform. And you need some brand of professional representation. And I did a workshop sort of production, this sort of Commedia dell'arte. Mm-hmm. And one of the actresses in it said, "Hey, I know a guy who's a manager," and I told him, "And so you can go meet him." So I ended up going off and meeting a classic kind of like showbiz manager. "So you think you got what you want, kid, huh?" They say, "Oh, that right? Well, let me tell you what the secret of all of this is: potential. That's the secret of this business, and you got potential." So this very old school manager ended up sending me around to some agencies. Mm-hmm. Agencies that would never have had me in were it not for a phone call from somebody like my manager. And that ended up being part of a go-see audition cattle call that the American Broadcasting Company was running. And this happened very fast. I can't tell you the speed with which this happened. It was like lightning. They say you're going to go to LA. We're going to fly out to the coast. We're going to fly out to the coast. And I had I didn't have a credit card and I had no money and I didn't even know how I was going to get around. And they gave me these vouchers for taxi cabs in Los Angeles, and it was surreal. And I would go out and I would do what they said. I'd be in some hotel for 3 days, and then I would go back. And they said, "Oh, you shouldn't have gone back. We have a few more things." I kept going back. Well, then, lo and behold, found out that they had signed me to this talent deal. I was part of the class. I didn't even know.
It's just sort of remarkable to kind of get your head around this because you are a total unknown at this point. Like, you are a nobody. No one knows you. There's an open cattle call. And you're auditioning for the show that would become, of course, Bosom Buddies. And you were a Shakespearean actor. Like, that's what you had been doing for the previous 3 seasons. And it's almost like you were back in your apartment in Alameda horsing around with your brothers and sisters.
That was the character that you... Yeah, that was it.
Right?
There is something to do. Look, the experience of doing Shakespeare with trained professional actors... if you got to go out on stage and make sense of saying the Duke does greet you, General, and requires your haste post haste appearance even on the instant, if you got to make that thing sing, that's great training in order to walk into a room and say, "What's the intent of what this character is?" And, "Oh, I see." On one hand, it's very funny, but on the other hand, you've got to be a real guy. In the theme of the job I did not get, I had been out and was auditioning for everything that they wanted me to audition for. And you get called into the network in which you're sitting in the waiting room, honestly, with 27 other actors. And they're literally figuring out who's going to be in what and who's going to be sent home.
Yep.
And I went in and read for the TV version of Foul Play.
Great movie.
And they said that was great, Tom.
Barry Manilow.
Can you go sit in that office right there and we'll come talk to you in a second? And I said, okay. So I sat at some guy's desk at ABC in Century City. And Bob Boyette came in and he said, well, we don't want you for Foul Play. Hmm. I said, okay. He said, we want you to do Bosom Buddies, which I had auditioned for.
Yeah.
I said, okay. And that and that was that. And that was that.
I was watching, I went down a Bosom Buddies rabbit hole the other day.
How do you even find it?
Are they
on YouTube?
Okay. You can find it.
Right.
And I remember watching it as a kid. And what's remarkable is that it's a physical role. Like, you are a physical comedian. It's almost like you see elements of like Kramer from Seinfeld or Chandler from Friends that would happen, you know, decades later. You weren't just like this kind of, you know, fun-loving guy. Like, you were – it was a physical role. I mean, did that kind of acting come more naturally to you because of where you came from and how you grew up versus the kind of acting that you had been trained to do for the previous 5 or 6 years?
I think that I had been cast an awful lot as that guy who did very physical stuff. When I played Grumio in Taming of the Shrew, I was all over the place. I was flopping left and right. I was getting beat up. I was getting smacked. I was being dragged by an imaginary horse on stage. The physicality of it kind of went into being the Shakespearean clown. That was still just me goofing around in the living room in a pair of socks, seeing how far you could slide before you ran into the glass door, you know, the sliding glass door.
I'm curious about your personal life. I mean, you were living on unemployment like 6 months before that. You were getting no work in New York City. You had children. You were unknown. And you're now on a national network television show that at that time was watched by tens of millions of people, presumably. That must have just kind of rocked your world. I mean, you were all of a sudden famous. Like, did you?
Not really. I would say no. No, I was a celebrity in a way that the only way it could sort of translate like it was like so is that I'd be at baggage claim.
Yeah.
And somebody would say, hey, are you that guy from Bosom Buddies?
Yeah.
So the show was only on the air for 2 years.
But you were making money for the first time in your life.
I was making money, just barely staying above water because the cost of living in Los Angeles and having a car. They didn't ply us with a ton of money. I mean, look, I had enough money to make house payments, but only for a year. And by the time the show was over, my daughter Elizabeth was born. So you had two kids and a house in the valley and waiting for the phone to ring. And whatever nut that you were able to put away was, you know, it was quite dwindling. The thing that happens after your show is canceled is that you're on a show that's been canceled.
Yeah.
So there is, on one hand, there's an onus, as in, kid, you had your shot.
Yeah.
It didn't pan out.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, the other thing that can happen is, well, this he was pretty good on that show. So other people, some other interests would come around to it. But it's not like, oh, gosh, can we get that guy? It was just like he might work out. So there was there were a couple of years there where to be an unemployed actor, middle class unemployed actor with a dwindling bank account and car payments and two kids, and be waiting for the phone to ring, that's not the greatest way to go to bed every night at 11 o'clock. But it also didn't, I have to say again, it did not last for a very long time. I got to say, lightning quick, I ended up meeting the guys who wrote Splash, who said, hey, that guy that was in that guest episode of Happy Days, he might be good. And Ron Howard is just starting out.
As a director.
And they were getting into writing features. And I was just coming in, I thought, to read for the Funny Brother, because those were the roles that I was reading for. Funny Brothers, kooky sidekick, the guy with energy, you know, the loudest guy in the room. And Ron said, okay, I want you to come in. I want you to read, but I don't want you to read for the brother. I want you to read for Alan. And I said, oh, okay, all right. And Ron said, you know, that's the lead. I said, okay. Meaning is like, take this seriously. I mean, come in. I'm giving you the, he didn't say so much, but he was saying, I'm giving you the opportunity to win the job.
Wow.
So come in and read for it. And I did. And I worked hard and, I prepared and he taped it back in the rudimentary home video taping system, on a thing. And he ran me through some exercises and I had to, change pace and I had to do it. But then that was that. And he called me up a couple of days later and he said, hey, hi. Yeah, it's Ron. Hey, listen, you got the job, but I need a favor. He was like, okay, you go back to that first thing you said, Yeah, you got the job. Okay, yeah, no, you got the job. It's going to be great. You're perfect, but I need a favor. And I said something to the point, yes, Mr. Howard, what can I do for you? And he said, the studio is finding me on Daryl Hannah. He really wanted Daryl Hannah. Yeah. And the studio said, well, fine, but how good is she and what does she look like? So Ron said, I need you to come in and do an on-camera test that is not going to be your test. It's going to be Daryl
test
because she's great. Yeah. Right. And I said, okay, all right. I don't know what a real camera. And he said, on video. I said, no, this will be a real camera test. I didn't know what that was. I mean, it was lights and 35 millimeter and a camera dolly and push-ins and push-outs and a scene, the whole bit. And when he said, okay, yeah, sure, I'll come in and do it. But on the day of the test, I said, hey, Ron, is there any chance at all that I blow my job in this camera test? I mean, is it possible? He said, no, we're just going to see the back of your head. We won't even get a sense of who you are in it. I just want to see you guys on camera at the same time. And, the rest is some brand of cinematic history.
And this sort of begins a sort of this period of, a collaboration that you would go on to continue with Ron Howard, collaborations you would have with Robert Zemeckis, with Nora Ephron, with Steven Spielberg. When I say collaborations, I mean literally like getting into the script with these directors, working on changing the character, investing in movies that weren't fully funded. Let's talk about Ron Howard for a moment, because you would go on to make many films with him. How did that collaborative relationship begin? Because sometimes it can be heavy-handed, right? Where the star is saying, I want to do it this way. But from everything I've read about the way you've collaborated with all these different directors, it was really a collaboration. It was like, let's sit down and have fun. And so what do you remember about Ron Howard? Like when you were in Splash, you were not a powerful Hollywood actor. Were you able to change that character, or were you able to put your stamp on that film in a way that felt right to you?
This is all about what the collaborative process are, and there's some people that realize that Ron would come with the bare bones and have faith that somebody is going to add spice to the stew.
There's
plenty of it. Here's the shot. Here's bang, bang, bang. This is what we're doing like that. But Ron started off of saying, what else? Anything else we can bring to this? And that was, on one hand, sort of in tune with, I'll go back to Grumio in Taming of the Shrew, because it's just lines unless you add stuff to it.
Yeah.
How about if we try this? What if this means that? I didn't realize for a while that that's what directors like Ron and Bob and Steven and Nora want from the reason they're casting you in the first place. They want you to have some idea that is in tune with what the text wants, and yet can only be provided by whoever is playing the role. And I would be so dumb, I'd have all sorts of ideas because I did not know how movies were made. And Ron would point out to me, we can't do that because that's a whole other shot. He's literally saying, what can we do here? What can we do in this scene that is covering this bit? And I remember there was one, they had built a stage that was in the apartment building that Alan lived, and there were elevators on both sides of the hallway. And there was a button for both elevators. And I didn't know why. Only one elevator worked, because it was a set. So they said, well, look, I'm in a real hurry because I'm trying to find her. She's left the apartment. I got to go find her out there somewhere. And I'm in a real hurry. So what if I come out? And he says, okay, all right, so, you know, come out and press the button and wait for the elevator. And I said, well, that's exciting. Okay. So, but because there were two buttons, I ran out and I said, hey, how about this? And I ran out and I pushed one button and I ran on the other side of the hallway and I pressed the other button and I just stood in the middle like I was waiting. Which elevator is going to come?
Yeah.
And then as soon as the elevator started opening, I ran into that elevator. And Ron said, yeah, let's do that. But we're going to have to push the camera back so we can see. So that's the type of thing that collaborative directors are going to want. The good directors come in and said, what do you make of this here? You know, what can we do here? The danger here is that for an actor, you have to accept no.
Yeah.
Hey, how about if we try this? That ain't it. Let's try something else. And that is the collaborative process that if you're not, look, I'll tell you right now, Guy Raz, the reason why all these people like working with me, I think, is because I show up on time.
Yeah.
I'm not late.
And you're ready. You're prepared.
I get there ready. Yeah. You know, Dan Sullivan at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival yelled at us one day when we were rehearsing Taming of the Shrew because Hamlet had opened the night before and the principal cast was all kind of hungover and we were late and we were tired and it was hot. And he got mad at us because, hey, man, you people don't have any energy. Don't you understand? You got to show up. You got to be here on time. You got to know the text and you got to have an idea because I can't do this all myself. And I just thought the value of having an idea, you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But that means you're coming in with some brand of forward momentum, something that is going to add something to it. And it's, you know, I have to say, I worked with a lot of people that say, hey, what do you make of this right here? And that's the sauce.
When we come back in just a moment, Tom breaks down what attracted him to the Forrest Gump script and how a dinner with Priscilla Presley changed his perspective on how to approach the role of Elvis's promoter, Colonel Tom Parker, in Baz Luhrmann's biopic. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. And let's get back to my conversation with Tom Hanks. Tom, I'm curious. I was just thinking about all the films you've been in. Obviously, we can't talk about most of them, but it's pretty remarkable because I mean, I've seen most of the films you've been in, almost all of them, and you just do. And I think a lot of people can say that. And I think about the characters in the films you've been in. You know, you've played Mr. Rogers and Ben Bradley and Colonel Tom Parker and Forrest Gump and Andrew Peck in Philadelphia. I can go on. I mean, Walt Disney, Charlie Wilson. And what's remarkable about the arc of your career is you've made so many films and very few of them have bombed, you know, and I wonder how you, I mean, there have been a few, but very few given the number you've made.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anybody who plays pro
is
ball
gonna
lose, loses
right.
games,
But I
you
wonder
know?
How yeah. how you have, I mean, it seems like your judgment for the scripts you choose and the roles you play is obviously very good, and I wonder how you make those decisions. Like, for example, Forrest Gump, you know, somebody could have read that script just on paper and thought, oh, this is weird, or this is kind of schlocky or pastiche or whatever. And you saw that script and you thought, this is going to be an incredibly successful, this is going to be a mega, like, Well, I don't know, maybe that's not what you thought, but...
Well, you're giving me more credit. Look, without a doubt, I was attracted to it for a very specific purpose because I deemed relatively quickly that my version of Forrest was he could only operate at the speed of his own common sense. That's it.
Yeah.
He had no knowledge beyond what Mama and Jenny told him.
Yeah.
That was it. But that's just not the guy who plays Forrest Gump. Bob Zemeckis and Eric Roth, who wrote the screenplay, Gary Sinise, Michael T. Williamson, and Sally Finn and Robin Wright. Right, yeah. We all sat together for weeks with Bob, and Bob was saying, "Well, what do we make of that?" We start at the beginning of the script, and we all talked about everything. Even scenes we're not in, and what it meant to the text. That was like, you must know the text. That doesn't mean your own lines. You must know the text, because the text is the interpretation of the theme, and the theme is why you're all there in the first place. If I was going to say, and look, I don't know how to communicate instincts, but it's the thing that always lands. The question I ask myself is, is the theme of this movie worthy of the time and effort and examination of it to draw people into it, become involved? And a movie like that, because it was all about, oh my Lord, there were so many lessons to learn from that.
I'm curious if you could break down how you become a character. And obviously there are too many, you know, whether it's Ben Bradley or Captain Phillips or whatever, but let's talk about a recent character of yours, Tom Parker, because he was different than a lot of characters you played in the sense that he was not a nice guy, right? I mean, he was not an easy person to like. There's certainly elements about him that we are sympathetic towards, and he's complex. But I couldn't help but walking away from that film feeling like he really screwed over Elvis, that he really kind of ruined his life. I mean, forcing him to perform in Las Vegas for 7 years in a row. But aside from that, just before we talk about, you know, the complexity of who he was, help me.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack.
Help me understand how you become that character. So Baz Luhrmann says, I want you as Tom Parker. This is a guy who is like Dutch, but he kind of hid that. He pretended like he was sort of a Southern honorary colonel, all these weird things. He hit his past. How did you sort of build the architecture for me about how Tom Hanks then transforms into this character that becomes convincing for a viewer?
I was very lucky because I had no idea what Colonel Tom Parker looked like. I had no idea what he sounded like. I had the same sense that, oh, Colonel Tom Parker, he must have been a foghorn and leghorn kind of guy. Well, let me tell you here, son. Right. I'm not going to tell you what you're going to do right now. And I had heard stories from my makeup man, Danny Strepek, who did Elvis for four movies, including Viva Las Vegas. And the first thing I ever heard about Colonel Tom Parker, oh, he was just a low-class carny. That's all he was. He'd cheat you out of a quarter, you know, that kind of thing. That's what I'd heard, but I did not know what he looked like. And when I did see what he looked like, I asked Baz Luhrmann, why do you want me? this is a heavyset balding man with, you know, a hawk-like nose with this weird accent that no one can actually place. And so my question was, okay, boss, let's collaborate. Mm-hmm. What are you going for here? Are you going for the physical look? And he said, oh, yes, yes, yeah. So we're talking about a substantial amount of prosthetics in order to make me look like Colonel Tom Parker. He says, oh, yes, 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 yes. I said, okay. Now, I had just played Falstaff in a production of Henry IV here in Los Angeles. Because the other thing is, okay, so that's what you're going for as far as look, and I'm going to assume the same thing is going to voice, because I've received, you know, commands from directors. Oh, you're going to do a dialect. That's okay. All right. Very good. So then after that, it's like, and why are you, Mr. Baz Luhrmann, what are you trying to crack here with an examination of the Elvis story? Because the myth has been done to death.
Right.
The myth has been has become accepted as the truth. And he says, exactly. As far as Colonel Tom Parker is concerned, he said, without a doubt, there would have been no Elvis Presley without Colonel Tom Parker. The other side of it is, there would have been no Colonel Tom Parker without Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, now you're talking about the ego of a man. Now you're talking about a man who wants to, who is in this for two things, the power of running the show and the delight of screwing the rubes. That's what we discovered. Yeah. He was a carny, meaning that the carnival comes to the small town on the out in the outskirts. You put up the lights, you put up the Ferris wheels, you put up the tents. Those people are going to come. They cannot help themselves. And your job is to give them the greatest night of their lives, one thrill after another, one amazing moment after another, one delight after another, and also take them for every dime you can. And that twin delight is what comes with. Colonel Tom Parker's favorite movie was Nightmare Alley. He loved it because that was how they took the rubes. For 25 cents, they provided you with a nickel's worth of entertainment. So you start studying that around, and there's a ton of stuff about the background. Yeah, he was from Holland. He got into the carny business as a very young man over there. His desire was to run Barnum & Bailey's Big Top Circus. That's what his dream. Yep. He jumped ship once and stayed and then went back. And then when he came back again, probably for scurrilous reasons, not just dodging his past, but perhaps the law. No one knows for sure. And then adopting a whole, he called himself Tom Parker. And then one day he was awarded an honorary colonel, made an honorary Kentucky colonel by, the mayor Knoxville, Tennessee, or something like that, or someplace in Kentucky. And so then he adopted Colonel Tom Parker. That's how it was. And he still had that crazy, the odd voice, but, Colonel Tom Parker. Now, here's where it ends up going south. Rita knows Priscilla Presley.
And that's Rita Rita Wilson, your wife, who's also an actor.
Yeah. So they happen to run into each other in a restaurant here in L.A. Mm-hmm. Rita, hey, Priscilla. Oh, Tom, we're so excited that, Tom's going to be doing the Baz movie about my husband, Well, would you like to come up? Could come up and we'll have dinner. We'll talk about it. And so not only did Priscilla come up, but Jerry Schilling, who was a member of the original Memphis Mafia, who knew Elvis from high school touch football games, back in Memphis, they came up and I said, please give me a great horror story about Colonel Tom Parker. And they looked at me and they said, we don't have any horror stories about Colonel Tom Parker. Huh. And I said, look, you don't have to be nice, don't worry about it. I said, no, Colonel Tom Parker was a lovely man who was a delight to be around, who showed nothing but the greatest respect for my husband. Huh. And my husband would not have become what he did without Colonel Tom Parker. Jerry Schilling said, I wish he was still alive today because I could talk to him on the phone once a week.
Wow.
He took care of Priscilla Presley long after the divorce. He called her every Sunday, said, how are you doing? How's your daughter? Wow. Is there anything I can do for you? If there's anything that I need. Now, she also said, look, he was a carny and we had to sue him for the money that he owed us. But, that's because he was not my husband's manager. He was my husband's promoter. And both Jerry and Priscilla, described Elvis in a term that I think you would probably use for a great artist like Picasso or maybe Eugene O'Neill or something. They said, you have to understand, the only thing that mattered to my husband was music, performing music. At 3 o'clock in the morning, if he wasn't in bed, he would be downstairs playing gospel on the piano in the living room. That's what he wanted to do. He could not say yes or no. He said, yes, sir, of course. Yeah. He took guidance. And if you take this reality, there's this old story. It's not in the movie, unfortunately. I wish it was, in which the colonel said to Elvis, son, right now you have $1 million worth of talent. When I'm done with you, you'll have $1 million. And that's true. From the signing with Colonel Tom Parker, in which he was essentially making a living by performing on the, you know, around in small clubs and selling records out of the trunk of Sam Phillips's car. He went from that to moving into the Graceland mansion, which he bought cash, you know, within 18 months. Yeah. So that's what Colonel Tom Parker did for Elvis. The genius of Colonel Tom Parker cannot be overstated, but it is all washed away, I think, from the great legacy of the late 60s and 70s in which the Colonel was wrong. Mm. So at the end of the day, you have to say, what did Colonel Tom Parker do for Elvis? He made all of his dreams come true. At the same time, he turned him, I think, into the elephant chained up inside a tent that people paid 25 cents to see. Now, that's the story. I didn't really talk about the character. I mean, that's the logic of what has to come out in the character. So when I'm talking about, you have to understand, I have to understand the logic of why these people do what they did. Colonel Tom Parker ran Elvis's career in a very specific kind of way. Why? Mm. It's because he knew he had Picasso. And in order to make Picasso more valuable, you have to make him less accessible. And so he took him off of TV. Yeah. If you wanted to see Elvis Presley, there was only one way to do it. You wouldn't see him on the Steve Allen show after that one thing. You wouldn't see him on Tonight Show. You had to buy a ticket, you had to buy a record, or you had to listen to pay radio, in which they made money off of every time they played.
I wonder, though, I mean, your portrayal of Tom Parker, I mean, I'm sort of kind of gobsmacked that Priscilla Presley, you know, was saying those things about him, because while your portrayal was certainly sympathetic and you walk away understanding that he was responsible for Elvis's stardom, you also walk, or at least I walked away from your portrayal thinking that there are sociopathic tendencies in him, that he's a man who lacked empathy.
I think that's where you get into the aspect of who's got the power here? I do, you know, because you want my boy. And if you want my boy, you're going to have to give me exactly what I want. That's just the way it works. I think the tragedy that hurt both of them was the Colonel's lack of imagination. But even from Priscilla, it's like Elvis did not have a business bone in his body, but he could have said no.
Do you know what she thought of the film and your portrayal of Tom Parker?
Well, I will tell you this, that there isn't anybody that portrays Elvis without going through some part of their rights, the family, the estate. And they've been burned many times. Because the myth of Elvis is the thing that carries the day. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they were very pleased, and I think rightly so. Because I think the great power of Baz's movie is it gets fascinating after the 1968 comeback special. Yeah. Because that's where the almost like Greek tragedy starts kicking in. And the myth is Elvis got fat. He did a lot of drugs. He gave lousy shows and he shot a TV. You know, that's pretty much it. He went nuts in a Las Vegas hotel room. And he did do really bad shows, and he did get addled, and he did shoot a TV, and he was affected by drugs. But it's in the movie, that last concert, that voice never left, and that power never left, even though he was bloated, and he was tired, and I think they were just happy, I don't want to speak for them, I think they were just happy that her husband and Lisa Marie's father was portrayed as an artist that struggled. And so, as opposed to, you know, an example of sloth or greed or avarice.
I wonder with all the roles you played, right? Ben Bradley and Mr. Rogers and Jim Lovett at Apollo 13 and Walt Disney and Charlie Wilson. Who do you most identify with? Like, who do you think you are most like?
I'm not like any of these guys because I don't have the wherewithal or the stick-to-itiveness. But I will say there's a number of things that I reacted to immediately. Charlie Wilson, he wanted to kill Russians. Mm-hmm. That's it. He wanted to take them on head to head. Hey, they're the bad guys, and we've lost to them every time. Let's go get them. I get that. Hey, let's take a shot. Let's see what we can do. I know this game. It's all a game, man. I know how to play the game. Let's play the game. Let's take out some of them Ruskies at the same time. I get that. I will say that the pressure of Chesley Sullenberger, Sully, his sense of responsibility as a professional pilot and what he went through on the miracle on the Hudson, and then also
the aftermath.
The hearing for the National Transportation Safety Board. Now, I when he walked me through that, I thought this is bone cracking pressure that this guy had underneath him, but not just in the moment, just as like flying a plane load of strangers from LaGuardia to Charlotte is a miracle if you accomplish it without anybody, you know, being hurt every single day. And I've gotten something or learned something powerful. And that's part of the reason why the throwing into the early process of learning about who these people are or forming the logic of who they are, because not everybody is a real person. And none of them are like me because at the end of the day, I'm just a guy. I'm a guy in high school saying, this is a class I can take. You know, I'm looking for the distraction that's going to make life interesting and fun. And now maybe it's work at the same time, but it ain't work to me.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, what Tom learned about grace under pressure from a chance meeting with baseball legend Joe DiMaggio. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. Here's more from my conversation with Tom Hanks. You've got a new film out, A Man Called Otto, and I think you've got a novel, your first novel coming out next spring, and you've already written a book of short stories. I mean, there's a lot of different things you do. You've directed, you collect typewriters. We won't have time to talk about that in detail, but all those things that you do, are all those things kind of requirements for you to just keep your kind of creative spark alive? I mean,
it is absolutely. That's absolutely what it is. I cannot wake up in the morning and not pursue some sort of like...
just some totally different...
Yeah, and I'm going to have to put that back to this is how I blew time on 4-hour Greyhound bus rides. You know, you're by yourself. There was no such thing as headphones or movies or anything like that you carry. I looked out the window and I daydreamed. I looked out the window and saw stories in my head. Some of it were about me, but others were just about much, 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 much bigger canvases and horizons. And if I was going to say, what do I do for a living? I am a professional storyteller. That's what I am. Sometimes I control the whole story. Sometimes I'm just a voice in it. And I can't imagine living without that brand of creativity. And I have to get up and ponder a story. I can't help myself. I don't watch a lot of TV. The kids are out of the house now. We don't have a dog. I get up and I can't help but think about, oh, you know, we're We have that thing down at the office. I wonder what the latest, you know, maybe we can add something to it like that. I have to say, I'm never bored because I always got these stories and these ideas that are rattling around inside my head. Sometimes they see the light of day, sometimes they don't.
You know, I mean, and this, I'm sure you've been asked a version of this question a million times, but I wonder, like, I imagine that the characters that seem like they're the hardest roles to play probably aren't, and the ones that people might think are easier to play are maybe the harder ones. Like, for example, you know, being Woody, just being a voice actor is really hard. Like, I've done that work. It's exhausting because you are physically moving, and it takes a lot of energy.
It's brutal. It's the hardest work you do as an actor because you cannot move. You do not have a costume. And you have to be right on the mic like this. If you're over here, you're not on mic, so you can't move. You got to get right down there. It's tough. But I will tell you this. It's all exactly the same. It is a constant like the speed of light. You hit a mark at a very specific place in time, and it works in real time. In a medium that is all artifice, there isn't a fake moment in it once the camera is rolling and you actually have to deliver these kind of goods. And I've worked with some of the greatest actors on the planet Earth. And when I watch them, I see them refreshingly battling the same self-consciousness that I feel every time it's time to start a job.
You feel it every time, even at 66?
Every single time.
What do you mean by that? How does that actually manifest itself? Is it anxiety? Is it?
All right. I will tell you this. This is a great story, man, because I couldn't believe it when it was happening. Years ago, I was in a restaurant in New York, and the maitre d' came over. Excuse me, Mr. Hanks. Says, yes. Mr. DiMaggio is having dinner in the hotel tonight. He wondered if you might come by and so that you could meet. And I said, Joe DiMaggio? And he said, yes, he's a regular here. I said, and I leapt up from the table and said, take it to him. And I sat down and I chatted with Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah.
He was just in by himself. So I said, well, it's a Mr. DiMaggio. I said, oh, please call me Joe. I said, oh, I can't. I said, you know, I've gotten a couple of reviews every now and again, and I have to say that when reviewers say, I make it look easy, I often think of what they said about you. You made playing center field look like it was natural and easy. And he said this to me, Tom, it always looked easy, except in here. And he held his big hands up over his heart. And he said, oh, it looked easy, but it wasn't in here. And I thought, he has just described what it is for me to stand up and say, okay, I'm this guy and I'm going to fall in love, or I'm going to do the thing, or I'm going to like be in the spacecraft or any of this. It's never easy, but the process is an instinctive one. And when you can let go of the self-consciousness of the fallacy of it all. I made a movie called Road to Perdition with Paul Newman. Yep. Okay. All right. It's like playing catch with Joe DiMaggio, you know? And on the very first day we got together, you know, we got to know Paul was a magnificent man. He was, you know, he was very novel, very funny, very, you know, self-effacing, but there we all are. And the very first day of shooting was a big Irish wake. And so there was probably 60 extras, and they're all dancing and playing the piano and doing all this kind of stuff. And on the very first day, Paul had to get up and give a toast, you know, as his character. You know, he had to raise a glass of whiskey and, you know, say something. And to say that everybody on the stage was waiting for Paul Newman to deliver his first lines on the first day of a movie. And he did it, you know, and rolling and la la da 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 da. And he said something like that. And cut. And Paul just froze, and he looked at us all, and he said, you always feel self-conscious that first day, don't you? And everybody laughed. It's like, okay, so if even Paul, you know, has to fight that tendency of this is not a natural thing to do.
Yeah.
And yet if you do it well enough, it looks like it's the easiest thing in the world, and it never is.
Talking about Joe DiMaggio or any athlete, right? They hit their peak at around 32, maybe if they're lucky 35, right? And that's it. You know, if you're a professional basketball player, 31, 32. And you're in a profession where you can actually get better every time. Like you're 66, you've been doing this since you were 22 professionally, 23. And do you feel that way? Do you feel like with every character you take on, every role you take on, you have the opportunity to get better and that you actually do get better as an actor?
The only measurement I have for is by the stuff that I don't pay any attention to anymore. Meaning that when you're starting out, you think you have all these responsibilities outside of showing up, knowing the text, and having an idea. You think you've got to oversee props, and all of that stuff is just slipped by the wayside. The burden of thinking that there's all the stuff you have to keep track of actually gets in the way of what I think the real task at hand is, was to make sure to provide the pure motivation for the character that is obvious, but is something that's only locked inside your own brain. There's an example now, is like a lot of times, like the camera crew, you know, they'll say, "Hey, Tom, am I in your eye line here?" And I said, "Guy, I don't even see you guys anymore. I'm sorry. You know, you're fine. Don't worry about it. Because I don't see you anymore." Now, they're there. They're in my eyesight. But there is another, I just don't worry about it. So that at the age of, 66, there's just a ton of stuff I don't worry about anymore that doesn't interest. I must say that what has become even more important, however, and this is getting harder, is knowing the text so cleanly that you don't have to think about it. Most scenes in movies aren't going to last much longer than four pages, right? Four pages of give and take dialogue. But if you're doing a movie, you've got a day, maybe two, in order to nail that bad boy. And like in Bridge of Spies, if part of it is, you know, getting up in front of the Supreme Court and arguing a case, that's a lot of dialogue. But it can't just be dialogue. It has to be connected ideas in your head. The same way like your favorite Bruce Springsteen song that you've been singing since 1986. You have to know it so well that you can pick it up right in the middle of it. And that is requiring more time. I don't know how much time I'm actually going to have to give it 100% of the energy. Now, is it a technical thing that I've learned to do? Well, maybe it is, but it actually ends up feeding into that which will make me stronger as an actor that I was not able to do in movies when I was in my 30s or 40s.
You know, we were talking earlier about this just sort of crazy, you know, sort of maybe call it luck, call it fate moment, which led to you being picked to play Kip in Bosom Buddies. And, you know, your
Wilson.
Career, you know, then you go to Splash and then Nothing in Common and Big. And so one could look at your career and say, my God, you know, at what point could Tom Hanks ever have experienced self-doubt? And so I ask you that, like, because somebody could look at that trajectory and just say, my God, like, it's just a string of success, you know, from one to the next. And I wonder if you ever did have a moment of self-doubt or if you ever do now.
Well, you want to talk about just the last 24 hours and I'll walk you through moments of there is self-doubt that is pure neuroses. And I will say, Guy Raz, I am not a neurotic guy. I'm not. I don't get up. I don't fear death. And I don't operate by, oh, I might embarrass myself. I do not have that brand of self-doubt. And I will say, at all, and dare I say, I never have.
Yeah, you're lucky.
All right? I am. Yeah. I am very lucky. I was able to look upon a Greyhound bus ride from Oakland to Red Bluff, California as an opportunity to look out the window and daydream, you know, and come up with stories in my head. So that brand of self-doubt, I think I'm very blessed in that you can call it some degree of confidence if you want to, or you can call it chutzpah, moxie, whatever. My areas that when I wake up at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning and end up looking at myself in the mirror in the bathroom and I wonder what in the world has happened to me, I wrestle with authenticity. I wrestle with the difference between lying for a living as an actor and lying to myself as a human being. Mm-hmm. My work has to reflect some brand of ethos. It did for my dad, you know. My dad hated the restaurant business. And then when he got out of it, he loved what he did. Yeah. You know, he was a commercial fisherman and stuff like that. And there's a way in order that what you do for a living really does represent what is important to your life. There's people that love their jobs, you know, and sometimes they're plumbers and they love their jobs. I love my job. And that what goes along with that, I think, is a responsibility to always walk this razor fine line between truth and falsehood, between, you know, consistency and presence. I know the import that I myself put on being in the audience. When I'm just sitting watching anything, I take that contract that I have with the people who I'm watching very, very seriously. I'm in the audience, and my job is to let these people take me there. That's why I'm here. Please show me something I've never seen before. Even if I've seen this production of Hamlet, show me something new in Hamlet. When I'm on the other side of that, it's like, you
got it.
It's a money back guarantee, man. You've got to bring it on. And I there's movies I don't watch of my own, some of which you've mentioned now as big hits, because I see the falsehood in them. I see the loss. I see that one time. Oh, man, I missed that opportunity. And it's not because at the moment I chose not to. It's because after it was done, I realized I didn't go far enough. I didn't go to the place that I could have gone. And then I asked myself, well, why? Was it because I was satisfied with what I had? Was it because I wasn't up enough on the text? Was it because I didn't have enough of those ideas in my pocket? Or, you know, is it because I was late that day and we had to rush the shot? And instead of six passes, we only got two passes at it? That's where the self-doubt creeps in, because acting in a movie requires, I think, the same equipoise as great athletes do. Mm-hmm. And by mean equipoise, it means that permanent state between relaxation and concentration. Yeah. And that means if you're in a scene and everybody gets their close-up, when it comes around on you, you better pull your weight. You know, you better be there as much as they were. And oh, that's where the night sweats and the terrors come along. You think, what is acting? What is performing? And why can some people do it and some people can't? And it's because it's the battle against self-consciousness. I remember never wanting to wear a hat in anything. Literally said, I don't want to wear a hat. Why? Because I look stupid in hats, right? And then we made The Green Mile with Frank Darabont. And we had a loving ensemble on that. And we had this logic that was established that I really loved. When we executed somebody on The Green Mile, that meant it was the formal occasion. And so we all wore our hats, our uniform hats. And Frank said, I don't know if we need the hats right there. I said, Frank, we got to have the hats. We've got to have the hats. Because when we're running Old Sparky and we've done the tests and we've got the generators going, we know we are going to be killing a man. We're going to be executing a man that night. You have to give us the guards, the uniform as armor. Because we don't wear our hats day in and day out. We only put those hats on when we're going to execute somebody. And Frank would say, I get that. But I don't know. You're wearing hats indoors. Yes, we're wearing the hats indoors. Because it's official now. And he finally said, I don't know, man. I think you kind of look silly in a hat. Which is something I had said 8 million times in my career prior to that. And then my defense was, well, yeah, I do, because that's what I look like in a hat. And we won the argument. We wore the hats in the bit. And that kind of that self-consciousness is the difference between being able to go there and not go there. If you're distracted by something on the stage, or if you don't have the text in your head and you're not working on that brand of idea, you will be self-conscious about how you look and how you sound. And that is the death of acting.
I think many people can relate to this idea of like authenticity, and also, I mean, even, you know, I've interviewed 25,000 people. There are interviews I can't listen to because I hear the flaws and the questions I didn't ask. And also, right. You know, there's a public persona and a private persona, and often they are the same, but there's a heightened version, right? Like people who listen to my show probably think that I'm always really nice and positive, but sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm negative. And so I guess my question to you is, why do you do it? What motivates you to go out and play these characters? Like Marlon Brando sort of famously, and I don't know if this is apocryphal, but like he did it to collect a paycheck. Like he really was like a carpenter. He went out, he got a job, he made the cabinet, and then and so why do you do it? What gets you out of bed to go to a set to play that part?
I will tell you this. I actually have an answer to this question. I'll go back to Vincent Dowling, artistic director of the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival. The very first rehearsal of that production of The Cherry Orchard at the Sacramento Actors Theater, I think was what it's called. I'm there because I did not get cast in What the Butler Saw out at Sac State. We were sitting around. We were about to have a read-through for the first time. And he made a little speech, you know, an Irish guy, you know, awfully good with that kind of a bit of a blarney. And he was talking about why we must be actors, you know, why we're here, why the theater, you know. He said, we're all here because there's nothing else like this. You know, there are poets and there are artists and there are singers and there are musicians. And they do it because it's the only thing they can do. But I believe that work in the theater is more fun than fun. And I heard that. And I'm not kidding you. I mean, I'm 19 years old or however it was. I said, that's the way I feel. You know, in high school, doing a play in high school, it's not like going to high school. It's like doing a play. It's like it is more fun than fun. Look, the work is hard. I don't want to discount that. But the essence of that goes into, why did Joe DiMaggio put on that San Francisco Seals uniform and go out and play doubleheaders in September? Because there's no life like it. There's something that is so grand, even if you lose the game. What you have experienced is all this time invested in equipoise, that state between concentration and relaxation, that the only other time you might get that, I think, is when you're babysitting your infant children, you know, and they're walking around the room and you have to keep an eye on them in case they fall and bonk their head on the edge of the coffee table. So you have to be right there. But at the same time, you're right there just laughing at because you're cracking you up. They're better entertainment than TV. I don't want to be cheesy about it, but it's more fun than fun, and the crackling sense of being alive when something is expected of you and you have to hit those marks. A lot of people can hit the marks. Not everybody can tell the truth, and not everybody can tell the truth without just a ton of struggle.
That's Tom Hanks. His newest film is A Man Called Otto. And keep an eye out this spring because Tom might just rack up another Oscar nomination for his performance in Elvis. By the way, despite being one of the biggest movie stars on the planet, you might occasionally still find Tom riding the New York City subway.
Every now and again, if someone makes eye contact with me and they just kind of go that kind of like body language that says, what are you doing down here? And my body language says, you know, I got an appointment downtown. And their eyes kind of say, good to see you. And my eyes say, thank you.
To find links and show notes from this episode, go to thegreatcreators.com/Hanks. We put some clips of Tom and Bosom Buddies and the trailer for A Man Called Otto. You can also find all of our previous episodes and show notes at thegreatcreators.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Hey, thanks so much for listening to our episode this week. If you liked what you heard, we've got one simple request. Please tell someone about it. Share a link, tweet, or post a story and hashtag The Great Creators. You can find us on social media by searching The Great Creators. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and I'm even on TikTok as Guy Raz. Spread the word, and thanks. This episode was produced by Nat Hoops and edited by Michael May, with help from Jeff Rogers. Thanks also to Kevin Leahy, Elaine Coates, Jenna Gedman, Andrea Bruce, Diana Mustak, Michelle Triant, and Daniel Shukin. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to The Great Creators from Built It Productions. Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure, and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? Then check out the daily news podcast, The Best One Yet. Every morning on The Best One Yet, hosts Nick and Jack serve up to three of the most interesting business news stories and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies, your going for that promotion at work, or you just want to know the trends before your friends, be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus, and for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.